2 Samuel chapters 19 and 20, the 11th talk in a series on 2 Samuel, was presented by David Crabtree on May 16, 2010 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2010. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at 2 Samuel chapters 19 and 20. Just to refresh your memory as to where we are. Absalom, David's son, after a four-year period of lobbying his fellow Israelites for support, he rose up against David, and there was a rebellion, and it was a rebellion of significant proportions, such that David was forced to flee Jerusalem on short notice. He and his closest supporters, they fled from Jerusalem and went east, went across the Jordan, and sought sanctuary in a walled city on the other side of the Jordan. Absalom, meanwhile, had developed a significant sized army, had support from throughout Israel, and there was a battle that was waged between Absalom's army under Amasa and David's army under Joab, Abishai, and Ittai. And the battle took place in a wooded area in which David's forces were able to defeat the superior numbers of Absalom's troops because they were able to spread Absalom's army out. And it says in the text that more people died of the elements than died in battle. So people were spread out all over, and people died probably of some of thirst, some of hunger, some falling off cliffs in various ways. In that battle, Absalom was riding through the wooded area, and he got caught up in a tree, in the branches of a tree. His donkey went out from under him, and he was left suspended there, hanging from the tree. One of the soldiers from David's army observed that, and ran and told Joab, and Joab said, "Well, why didn't you kill him?" And the soldier said, "Because David told all of us that he wanted Absalom to be kept safe." And Joab said, "I would have given you a big reward if you'd killed him." And the soldier says, "But David said, don't do it." And Joab said, "Let me take care of that." Pushed him out of the way, and he went, and he and his, some of his servants killed Absalom. So messengers took back to David. David had stayed back in this walled city. The messengers took the message to David, announcing the two important pieces of news. The first one being that David's forces had been victorious. The second piece of news being Absalom is dead. And David responded very hard to that. It says at the end of chapter 18, verse 33, "And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And thus he said as he walked, 'O my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you. O Absalom, my son, my son.'" So David has taken this very hard. He's He's up in the chamber above the gate of the walled city, and he's in mourning. And that sets the stage then for chapter 19. First seven verses. Then it was told Joab, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourns for Absalom." And the victory that day was turned to mourning for all the people. For the people heard it said that day, "The king is grieved for his son." So the people went by stealth into the city that day, as people who are humiliated steal away when they flee in battle. And the king covered his face and cried out with a loud voice, "O my son Absalom, O Absalom, my son, my son." Then Joab came into the house to the king and said, "Today you have covered with shame the faces of all your servants, who today have saved your life and the lives of your sons and daughters, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines, by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. Now, therefore, arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants, for I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now." So David is in mourning, and word gets out that David is greatly distressed after having the news of the events of that day. And the soldiers who have fought for David, and these are soldiers who sided with David in a conflict that the odds were probably against David. So these are people who sided with David in spite of all appearances. And they've risked their lives for David. And yet David, after having heard what the soldiers had done, he is up in his room mourning and grieving over the death of his son. And so the soldiers coming back are aware of David's response, and it's as if they're feeling like they did something wrong. They're feeling like if David is mourning, if David is grieving, then what we did wasn't what we should have done. It feels all wrong. Something's wrong in this picture. So the soldiers are kind of slinking back. They feel ashamed and they're discouraged. So Joab comes to him, comes to David, and Joab's thinking, we've got a real problem here. That those people who risked their lives to save David and his household and his rule, they are feeling unappreciated after what has happened. And it's a dangerous situation. There's been a rebellion. And the country is still somewhat divided, and we'll see later on how divided it is. So Joab is coming to David, and his appeal is, you've got to look at this from a broader perspective. You've got to understand what the soldiers that risk their lives for you, you've got to understand what they're experiencing. And you've got to look at this from the perspective not of a father, but from the father of a son who just died. You've got to look at this from the perspective of a king whose soldiers have just won back the kingdom for him. You have to set aside your personal concerns here and think about this in a kingly fashion. And that's his appeal. He says in verse 6, by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. I mean, that's how he has covered all of his servants with shame. For you have shown today that princes and servants are nothing to you. For I know this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased. That would be a difficult thing. That would be a difficult thing to swallow if you were one of the soldiers who risked your life for David. And so, just from the perspective of the soldiers, David is making a horrible mistake. But beyond that, Joab's appeal is, he says, "For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now." Joab recognizes this is a really dangerous situation. Not only does David need to feel empathy for the soldiers who fought for him, but he's got to think about the kingdom as a whole and recognize how precarious his power is. This is politically dangerous. Okay, next section. So the king arose and sat at the gate. When they told all the people, saying, "Behold, the king is sitting in the gate," then all the people came before the king. Now Israel had fled, each to his tent, and all the people were quarreling throughout the tribes of Israel, saying, "The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies and saved us from the hand of the Philistines, but now he has fled out of the land of Absalom. However, Absalom, whom we anointed over us, has died in battle. Now then, why are you silent about bringing the king back?" So David listens to Joab's advice, and he comes down out of the chamber where he has been in mourning, and he goes to the city gate. That's the official area of the city. That's where official events take place. And he plants himself there in the city gate, and he greets the soldiers as they come back. And I'm sure that he thanks them and shows his appreciation for what they've risked on his behalf. So he heeds Joab's advice, and he averts what could otherwise be a catastrophe. Then the armies disperse. And that's been mentioned earlier, that the armies had dispersed after Absalom had been killed. They've gone back home. And now throughout Israel, people are saying, "Well, you know, David did a lot of good stuff for us. David was the one who kind of pulled this kingdom together. And now Absalom's gone. David's forces defeated Absalom's forces. Now it's probably appropriate for us to call David back in and reinstate him as king." And there are people all over the kingdom of Israel that are making that argument, and so the support is building for David and calling for an official recognition of David being reinstated as king. Now, David is going to go through he's going to meet some people as he moves from Mahanaim on the other side of the Jordan. He's going to meet some people, and it's going to be some of the same people that he met when he was going from Jerusalem to Mahanaim. And as you will recall, as he was going from Jerusalem to Mahanaim, as he would meet people, sometimes it was encouragement because the people who met him were providing him with help and support. Other times it was discouragement as he found out who had turned against him. Now he's going to go back and meet some of those same people. Verse 11, "Then King David sent to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, saying, 'Speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house? Since the word of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house. You are my brothers. You are my bone and my flesh. Why then should you be the last to bring back the king? And say to Amasa, are you not my bone and my flesh? May God do so to me, and more also, if you will not be commander of the army before me continually in place of Joab. Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man, so that they sent word to the king, saying, "Return, you and all your servants." The king then returned and came as far as the Jordan. And Judah came to Gilgal in order to go to meet the king, to bring the king across the Jordan. David is apparently doing some politicking here. There's a political basis for his decision at this point. What he understands is that all over the kingdom of Israel, people have been saying, we need to reinstate David as king. But the rebellion that has just occurred seems to have had most of its support in David's own tribe, the tribe of Judah. If you will recall, when Absalom decided to stage this rebellion, he left Jerusalem and he went to Hebron. Hebron is right in the heart of Judah. So, and the commander of his army was Amasa, who was from the tribe of Judah. So apparently, this rebellion was largely supported by and the action of the tribe of Judah. Now, the tribe of Judah is also David's tribe, but he's moved himself to Jerusalem, and I suspect that there are people back home who are saying David is too closed. How would you say it? He's been too long in the Beltway. That he's lost touch with Peoria, and I suspect that was the appeal that was being made in Judah by Absalom and his supporters. In any case, it is important to David at this point that he have the full support of the tribe of Judah before he makes his re-entry into Jerusalem. Because without their support, he's still got a problem on his hands. So he makes an appeal to the tribe of Judah through the priests. Zadok and Abiathar both have been priests who have been loyal to David for a very long time. And he makes an appeal to them to speak to the elders of Judah and encourage them to take the lead in initiating this move to reinstate David on the throne. He underscores the fact that he too is from the tribe of Judah, reminds them of that fact, and he says, I will make Amasa, who had been the general under Absalom, he says, I will make Amasa my general under me. So that would mean Joab will be demoted and Amasa will be put in that place. So that's a huge concession that he's making to those who had been on the side of the rebellion. Okay, and by so doing then, David was successful in winning over the support of Judah. And so representatives of the tribe of Judah, they come out to meet David as he's about to cross the Jordan River. The next section. Then Shimei, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, who was from Bahurim, hurried and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. And there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons and his 20 servants with him. And they rushed to the Jordan before the king. Then they kept crossing to the ford to bring over the king's household and to do what was good in his sight. And Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king as he was about to cross the Jordan. So he said to the king, "Let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on the day when my lord the king came out from Jerusalem, so that the king should take it to heart. For your servant knows that I have sinned. Therefore, behold, I have come today, the first of all the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord the king." But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, Should not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed? David then said, What have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah, that I should this day be an that you should this day be an adversary to me? Should any man be put to death in Israel today? For do I not know that I am king over Israel today? And the king said to Shimei, You shall not die. Thus the king swore to him. Okay, if you'll recall, when David and his people were leaving Jerusalem, they went through Bahurim, and as they were passing through Bahurim, Shimei came out. And at this point in time, it looks like David is going to lose this conflict. The odds are definitely in Absalom's favor. And Shimei is cursing David and throwing stones at him, calling him all kinds of mean, nasty names. And as you will recall, Abishai, one of David's generals, said, Let me kill him. And David said, No, this is happening to me because of things that I have done wrong. And Shimei is accusing David of wiping out the household of Saul. Shimei is distantly related to the household of Saul. So David spares him, and Shimei keeps throwing the rocks and going along beside the army as they move along. Now the table's turned. Now David has defeated Absalom's forces. He's returning back to Jerusalem. He's going to be the king. So Shimei is coming to meet him because Shimei realizes that in all likelihood, David will just kill him now that David's in power. And so he comes with a whole bunch of men, and their purpose is to be servants to David as David and his household and all his servants are trying to get across the Jordan. Shimei and all of his men are going to help in that process. So he says, I don't know what I was thinking. I forget what I said. I didn't really mean it. I'm really on your side. And all that sort of thing. And David listens to him. Abishai also hears it, and Abishai is kind of always sings the same tune, off with his head. And so Abishai says, let me just off him. And David's response to that is, does he say sons of Zeruiah? He says son of Zeruiah. No, sons of Zeruiah. What have I to do with you, O sons of Zeruiah? Abishai and Joab are brothers. They are both the sons of Zeruiah. And the response of both of them is quite similar to these kinds of situations. It's always off with their heads. And David at this point is kind of exasperated. He's trying to smooth things out in a very tenuous situation. And here we have the sons of Zeruiah doing things that are just exacerbating the situation. So David says, No, no one's going to be put to death today. We want to restore the kingdom. And so he promises Shimei that he will not die. Next section. Then Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king. And he had neither cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came home in peace. And it was when he came to Jerusalem to meet the king that the king said to him, Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? So he answered, O my lord the king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go with the king, because your servant is lame. Moreover, he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your sight. For all my father's household was nothing but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who ate at your own table. What right do I have yet that I should complain any more to the king? So the king said to him, Why do you still speak of your affairs? I have decided. You and Ziba shall divide the land. And Mephibosheth said to the king, Let him even take it all, since my lord the king has come safely to his own house. If you will recall, as David was fleeing Jerusalem, he ran into Ziba. Ziba had been the servant in charge of all of Saul's possessions. And when Saul and Jonathan died in the battle, then Ziba was left in charge of all of the possessions that Saul had when he was alive. And David had made a covenant with Jonathan that he would always care for the descendants of Jonathan. He would not forget Jonathan's line. So once David was in power, he wanted to find out if anyone was remaining of Jonathan's line. And the only person he knew to contact was Ziba, because Ziba was taking care of Saul's possessions. And he found out about Mephibosheth. So David invited, he gave all of Saul's possessions to Mephibosheth. And not only that, he said, come to Jerusalem, you can dine at the table with me. And so David took good care of Mephibosheth all the time that David had been king. Mephibosheth, by the way, was lame. His foot was damaged when the household found out that Saul had died, and Mephibosheth was just a baby, and the servants were taking him out, and the servant dropped him, and he fell and damaged his leg, so he was lame for the rest of his life. So Ziba is still taking care of what had been Saul's possessions, now are Mephibosheth's possessions. And when David was leaving, Ziba came and met David and brought him two donkeys and a whole bunch of food for David and the people that were fleeing with David. And David said, well, where's Mephibosheth? And Ziba's response was, he stayed back in Jerusalem. And he said, today may be my lucky day. Today may be the day that I end up on the throne of Israel. So David was clearly very hurt by that. And on that day then, David said, okay, if that's the way it is, everything that was Mephibosheth's is now yours. And gave all of that to Ziba. Well, now, as in most situations, there's two sides to a story. We get the other side of the story. Here's Mephibosheth's story. Mephibosheth is saying, I just got left behind. I'm lame. I couldn't run after you. I was planning to saddle a donkey and come out to meet you. But, and he doesn't say this, but apparently what you're supposed to understand is Ziba took off with the donkeys before Mephibosheth was able to saddle one and get on it to ride out to David. So Mephibosheth was just stranded there. And Mephibosheth's appearance shows that he was not, he didn't care for himself or was not cared for while David was gone. It says that he had not cared for his feet, so I assume that means his toenails are long, nor had he trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came home in peace. I think those are important pieces of information to have, Because without those pieces of information, one could wonder, is Mephibosheth lying here? Fib is the middle part of his name. Is Mephibosheth lying here? But we have evidence that that is not the case. At least we have evidence that from the day that David left, Mephibosheth stopped caring for himself. And in those days, I think that would have been incontrovertible. He lets his fingernails, or lets his toenails grow, and he lets his mustache grow. And I'm assuming that that couldn't be faked back then. I'm sure it could be now. So, apparently Mephibosheth is being straightforward here. That what happened was Ziba took off without him, and he was left stranded there. It was not Mephibosheth's plan to try to take the throne. And to think that Mephibosheth, who is lame, is going to commandeer a rebellion that's being staged by Absalom sounds rather implausible to me anyway. So David's response is, and Mephibosheth is saying, that's what happened, but you have every right to do with me whatever you want to do, because I owe everything to you. I owe my life to you. Because way back when you found me, you could easily have killed me on the grounds that I was one of the few descendants of Saul, male descendants of Saul, and could have had a claim to the throne. But you didn't, and you treated me with the utmost kindness and graciousness. David's response it's hard to know exactly what is the nature of David's response. What he says is, why do you still speak of your affairs? And I don't know whether there's impatience there. That's possible. But I think it's more likely, you need not tell me anymore. I've already decided what needs to be done here. In any case, what he decides to do is to divide the land between Mephibosheth and Ziba. Ziba will retain half, and Mephibosheth will be given back half of the possessions that had originally belonged to Saul. Now, it seems to me that that's an unjust distribution. It seems to me that it would have been more appropriate for David to give all of it back to Mephibosheth and do something nasty to Ziba. But that's not what David does, and I think that's significant. The rebellion that was staged was a very dangerous rebellion. And David is doing everything he can to calm things down and be conciliatory. And I think this is another attempt to be conciliatory. Ziba shows up with Shimei and a group of people from that are referred to as being from what is it, the house of Joseph, and that seems to be the 10 tribes, the northern tribes of Israel. So David wants to kind of smooth things over with them. Next section. Now Barzillai the Gileadite had come down from Rogalim, and he went on to the Jordan with the king to escort him over the Jordan. Now Barzillai was very old, being 80 years old, and he had sustained the king while he stayed in Mahanaim, for he was a very great man. And the king said to Barzillai, cross over with me, and I will sustain you in Jerusalem with me. But Barzillai said to the king, how long have I yet to live, that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I am now 80 years old. Can I distinguish between good and bad? Or can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Or can I hear any more the voice of singing men and women? Why then should your servant be an added burden to my lord the king? Your servant would merely cross over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king compensate me with this reward? Please let your servant return, that I may die in my own city near the grave of my father and my mother. However, here is your servant, Chimham. Let him cross over with the Lord, with my lord the king, and do for him what is good in your sight. And the king answered, Chimham shall cross over with me, and I will do for him what is good in your sight. And whatever you require of me, I will do for you. All the people crossed over the Jordan, and the king crossed too. The king then kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his place. As you will recall, when David was leaving, Barzillai met him also. And Barzillai provided him with a great deal of support. There were he and four or five other important men from the other side of the Jordan all met David and provided him with a lot of support. And apparently he continued to support David the whole time that David and his household were in Mahanaim. And that was probably, it's not clear how long they were there, but it was probably a period of months that they were there, and David took a large entourage with him. So clearly support was going to be necessary. And Barzillai is providing that support. So that's a huge sacrifice on Barzillai's side. And it says that he was a very great man, and that means a wealthy man, a man of distinction and significance. So David says, let me return the favor. I mean, you've gone way out of your way to be supportive of me and my household. Please let me return the favor. You come back with me to Jerusalem, and I will support you now. And Barzillai's response is, no thanks. I'm 80 years old. I'm too old to enjoy the benefits of being in Jerusalem. I'm just going to go back to my city, and that's where I'll die, and that's the best place for me. But would you be willing to take Chimham? That we know from elsewhere. It says my servant Chimham, but we know from elsewhere that's his son. So he's saying, would you be willing to take my son and provide for him in Jerusalem? And David says, absolutely, absolutely. I will take him, and I will do for him whatever you want me to do. And if you have anything to ask of me in the future, just let me know, and I would gladly do what you ask. So then David and his whole entourage, with lots of help now, are crossing over the Jordan, and they're going to start back for Jerusalem. And David bids Barzillai farewell before he goes. Next section. Now the king went on to Gilgal, and Chimham went on with him, and all the people of Judah, and also half the people of Israel accompanied the king. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, why had our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over the Jordan? Then all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, because the king is a close relative to us. Why then are you angry about this matter? Have we eaten at all at the king's expense, or has anything been taken for us? But the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, we have 10 parts in the king. Therefore, we also have more claim on David than you. Why then did you treat us with contempt? Was it not our advice first to bring back our king? Yet the words of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel. So David is headed back for Jerusalem. And he gets most of the way to Jerusalem. And on the way then, he's accompanied by the leaders of Judah, and it says half of the leaders of Israel. So it's not just the leaders of Judah that are in this procession. But there is representation from the rest of the tribes of Israel. But there's another group of men from Israel, other leaders from the men of Israel, that come and confront them. And they say, why is it that you, the tribe of Judah, are escorting David back to Jerusalem? Why are you being given this honor of escorting him back into his throne, reestablishing him his throne? And it says, why had our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household and all David's men with him over to the Jordan? So they are seeing something fishy here. They're suspicious of what's going on. They're suspicious of a power play on the part of the tribe of Judah. And the men of Judah, their response is, well, David's also from the tribe of Judah. Doesn't it make sense that we would be especially highly represented in this group that's going back with David to Jerusalem? And why are you upset about this? Why is this such a big deal? We didn't steal anything. We aren't benefiting from this. We aren't getting a bunch of money and eating from the king's pantry. We're just escorting him back into Jerusalem. So clearly there's tension here. And the representatives of Israel are suspicious of the tribe of Judah. Their response is, look, we've got 10 parts in David. We have 10 parts of the kingdom and of the throne. You've only got one. And so we should be the ones who are primarily represented. Furthermore, we were the ones who first took a move to restore him to the throne. It wasn't you. You were the latecomers. So there's tension here, and that tension is going to be played upon in the next chapter, starting with verse 1. Now a worthless fellow happened to be there whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew the trumpet and said, we have no portion in David, nor do we have inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. So all the men of Israel withdrew from following David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. But the men of Judah remained steadfast to their king from the Jordan even to Jerusalem. So there's one individual there, this is Sheba, who uses this as his opportunity. He sees a problem here. He's particularly suspicious of the tribe of Judah. And he's saying, by the way, he's from the tribe of Benjamin, which was the same tribe as Saul. And the tribe of Benjamin here seems to be the most aggravated of the tribes of Israel with respect to the kingship being in Judah. So he says, everybody gather around. We have no share in David's throne. Everybody get ready. We're going to fight for our kingdom and take it back from Judah. So they follow Sheba and he departs, and they are going to amass elsewhere. But the tribe of Judah has been won over, and it remains loyal to David. And so we're going to have this conflict that's primarily between the tribes of Israel and the tribe of Judah, the tribe of Judah supporting David. Verse 3, then David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, the concubines whom he had left to keep the house, and placed them under guard and provided them with sustenance, but did not go into them. So they were shut up until the day of their death, living as widows. As you will recall, when David fled from Jerusalem, he left 10 of his concubines behind to take care of the household and to run the household in his absence. And that means taking care of his other servants that were left behind as well. So David left them behind, apparently thinking that they would be safe. because they are concubines. They wouldn't be as significant as his wives. They wouldn't be as significant as his key advisors. He's thinking that it would be safe to leave them behind. But when Absalom comes into Jerusalem, he does what was done throughout the ancient world when someone tried to take power from a king, that one of the first things that the usurper would do would be to sleep with the king's wives, if at all possible, because that is a way that communicates that he is staking his claim as the king, and he's making himself absolutely odious to the king, such that there is no going back. He is fully committed to taking over the throne. Absalom did that. So when David comes back, he sets those concubines aside. He cares for them the rest of their lives, but he doesn't treat them as wives. He doesn't even treat them as concubines. He doesn't sleep with them anymore. And they live up. They live much as widows would have lived at that time. The next section. Then the king said to Amasa, "Call out the men of Judah for me within 3 days and be present here yourself." So Amasa went to call out the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which he had appointed him. And David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba, the son of Bichri, will do us more harm than Absalom. Take your Lord's servants and pursue him, lest he find for himself fortified cities and escape from our sight." So Joab's men went out after him, along with the Cherethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men. And they went out from Jerusalem to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. When they were at the large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them. Now Joab was dressed in his military attire, and over it was a belt with a sword in its sheath fastened at his waist. And as he went forward, it fell out. And Joab said to Amasa, "Is it well with you, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard and his right hand to kiss him. Okay, so King David turns to Amasa, who is his new general now, who has replaced Joab. Remember, Amasa had been the general for Absalom, the opposition in the rebellion. But now David has made him the general of his army. And he says, "Call out the men of Judah and assemble within 3 days here. You come back too, and we got to go get Sheba. And we've got to do it quickly." So Amasa goes to bring together the troops, and he's not back within 3 days. And David's thinking, the time is ticking. We've got to get Sheba before he gets himself established in some fortified city where we can't get at him. So he turns to Abishai. He doesn't turn to Joab. Joab has obviously been demoted since he killed Absalom. But he turns to Abishai and he says, "We have no choice. We've got to act quickly. I want you to take the army that we have and go after Sheba and get him as quickly as you can." So they take off, and they get not too far north of Jerusalem, at which time Amasa catches up with them, and so the two armies are united at this point. And the narrator doesn't refer to Abishai here, but rather refers to Joab. So Joab's with them, and Joab is probably the one in charge, even though it is Abishai that David has given this assignment. So Joab, when Amasa arrives, Joab goes out to meet him. And Joab is dressed in military garb. He's got whatever armor on that would have been typical at the time. And he's got a sword that's in a sheath. And as he comes up to Amasa, he bows down. And when he bows down, the sword falls out of the sheath. And I would assume what happens is he reaches down and picks it up. So he's got it in his hand, unsheathed, but it doesn't look particularly menacing because it all makes sense. He just dropped it and he's just picking it up. And he grabs Amasa by the beard with his right hand to kiss him. A strange custom, but apparently it was common in the day. You grab the beard of the other person with your right hand and kiss him. Next section. But Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand. So he struck him in the belly with it and poured out his inward parts on the ground and did not strike him again. And he died. Then Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now there stood by him one of Joab's young men and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab." But Amasa lay wallowing in his blood in the middle of the highway. And when the man saw that all the people stood still, he removed Amasa from the highway into the field and threw a garment over him when he saw that everyone who came by him stood still. So Joab has the sword in his hand. He grabs Amasa by the beard, and they're kissing. And while they're kissing, Joab stabs Amasa. One time, he doesn't stab him twice. So Amasa falls down, and he's going to probably die slowly. I don't know for sure, but I suspect that's what's happening. Amasa just falls in a heap on the ground, and he is just spouting blood. And Joab says, "Okay, now let's go get him." Well, the problem is the majority of that army was an army that had been mustered by Amasa. They're more loyal to Amasa than they are to Joab. So every one of them, before they join Joab, has to go by the corpse of Amasa, their leader. And so they're all kind of, what do we do here? Who are we loyal to? And that's what Joab is forcing them to decide. And they aren't really sure that they like the idea of following Joab. So one of Joab's servants decides, this is not good. This is particularly divisive. So he covers Amasa up. And then he says, everybody who's for David and Joab, let's go. And so the army then moves out. Next section. As soon as he was removed from the highway, all the men passed on after Joab to pursue Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now he went through all the tribes of Israel to Abel, even to Beth Ma'akah and all the Berites. And they were gathered together and also went after him. And they came and besieged him in Abel Beth Ma'akah. And they cast up a mound against the city, and it stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab were wrecking destruction in order to topple the wall. Then a wise woman called from the city, "Here, here, please tell Joab, come here that I may speak with you." So he approached her, and the woman said, "Are you Joab?" And he answered, "I am." Then she said to him, "Listen to the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I am listening." Then she spoke, saying, "Formerly they used to say, they will surely ask advice at Abel. And thus they ended the dispute. I am of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. You are seeking to destroy a city, even a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" And Joab answered and said, Far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. Such is not the case. But a man from the hill country of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has lifted up his hand against King David. Only hand him over, and I will depart from the city." And the woman said to Joab, "Behold, his head will be thrown to you over the wall." Then the woman wisely came to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it to Joab. So he blew the trumpet, and they were dispersed from the city, each to his tent. Joab also returned to the king at Jerusalem. So the army takes off under the leadership of Joab at this point, and they go up after Sheba. Sheba has gone all the way north of the Sea of Galilee to Abel Beth Maacah, which is a walled city, obviously. And Sheba is inside the city, and Joab is thinking, well, the only way to deal with this situation is we're going to besiege the city, and we're not just going to wait until they're starved out. We're going to take active action to get Sheba and kill him. So they start building this mound, and I assume what they're building is a ramp that will allow them, a ramp that will go up to the top of the wall that they can send forces up and get right into the city. And they're also doing things to destroy the wall, maybe undermining the wall. I'm not sure exactly what they're doing. But clearly they're going to destroy the fortifications of this city so that they can get at Sheba. And a wise woman from the city, she comes out and she wants to talk to Joab. And she says, Joab, is that you? Listen to me. And Joab says, yeah, here I am. Say what you want to say. And she says, this city is a city that they used to come to for judgment. People who had disputes would come here, they would make their case, and a judgment would be made here in this city, and the dispute would be over. It would be resolved. So this city is known for its wisdom. And she says, I am, what'd she say? I am of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. So she's not a part of the rebellion. She is loyal to David. And so she says, what can we do? What can we do so that the city can be saved? Because this is no insignificant city. She says, you are seeking to destroy a city, even a mother in Israel. A mother in this context means that a city was established here, and it grew and it prospered so much that it sent out groups of people to settle in other areas around it. So this is a city of significance that has a lot of satellite cities that are attached to it. And so she's saying, why would you destroy Israel's inheritance? Why would you destroy that which God has given to us, this land and these cities? And Joab's response is, I'm not just out to destroy. Don't blame this on me. We're only here because there's a rebel inside your walls. If we could deal with that problem, we'll go home. And so the woman says, fine, we'll take care of it. So she goes into the city, talks to the people of the city, and encourages them to rise up and overthrow Sheba and put him to death. And that's what the city does. They chop off his head, and they throw it over the wall to Joab, and Joab looks at it and says, yep, that's him, and they take off. And the last section. Now Joab was over the whole army of Israel, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and Adoram over the forced labor, and Jehoshaphat the son of Ahilud was the recorder. And Sheba was scribe, and Zadok and Abiathar were priests. And Ira the Jairite was also a priest to David. So now, after this revolt of Sheba, we have a little listing of the administrators under David as king. There was a listing of the administrators under David as king when he first solidified power. And the listing was very similar. Some of them are exactly the same. The changes are, he still has Joab. Joab now is reinstated as the general over the army of Israel. Joab had been the head of it before. Benaiah is over those who, it's the Cherethites and the Pelethites. Those were the foreigners who had joined David when he was still in Philistia and had been with him all the way through. So these are apparently his bodyguard, essentially. And Benaiah is over them, and he was the one who had been over them before. Adoram is over forced labor. There was no secretary of forced labor before. This is the first one. And apparently, the practice of having foreigners in their midst used to supply forced labor, it was a practice that started as early as Joshua. When Joshua came into Israel, there were a couple of instances where he subjugated peoples and made them servants to the Israelites. Apparently that practice was continued up until the time and through the time of David, and now we have someone placed in charge of the forced labor. Jehoshaphat is made the recorder or the chronicler, and he had been before. Shiva is made the scribe. There had been a different scribe who was in that position before. Then Zadok and Abiathar continued to be the priests. They had had that position before. But it says, and Ira the Jairite was also a priest to David. That was not mentioned previously, so that's a new position. The significance of this little list of his administrators being placed here seems to be that now we are ending the story with respect to David's reign. We have four more chapters in 2 Samuel, but most commentators see those as a unit, and it's a unit that served as kind of an addendum to 2 Samuel. It's not part of the chronological account of David's rule. And so this list of administrators seems to be ending then the narrative of the period of David's rule. One of the things that becomes clear in looking at this section is that the rebellion that Absalom had put together was a serious rebellion. That it really looked like David was not going to be able to overcome this rebellion. Absalom was going to win. And so we see David going to extreme measures to try to find a way to conciliate and put the kingdom of Israel back together again, unify it again. And so he's being extremely conciliatory. Joab, on the other hand, sees this as too much. How can you bring in the rebels and after all that they have done? How can you reward them after all that they have done? So Joab takes it in his own hands to kill Amasa and show the rebels that they can't rebel and get away with it. In this section of 2 Samuel, the thing that I have been wrestling with, and it's the hardest to sort out for me, is how do you know when David is doing right and when he is doing wrong? How do you know when Joab is doing right and when Joab is doing wrong? In historical narrative, oftentimes that's hard to sort out, but it seems to me that's particularly hard to sort out in this section. There are times when the narrator will step forward and give you some kind of clear statement that indicates whether the narrator thinks that this was a good thing that was just done or if it was a bad thing that was just done. But we've had very few of those in this section. Sometimes there'll be a prophet standing forth speaking out on God's behalf and make clear where something was done right or when something was done wrong. But for the most part, in this section, we don't have either of those indicators. We've just got the narrative itself, and it's hard to sort out. in the first half of 2 Samuel, from my perspective, it seems to be pretty clear that everything David does is the right thing to do. He's kind of a rising star, and everything that he does is blessed with success, and David makes wise moves, and he does things that are exemplary, the kinds of things that we should all emulate. But then we get in the middle of 2 Samuel, and he commits adultery with Bathsheba, and then he kills Bathsheba's husband, Uriah. And at that time, Nathanael, the prophet of God, comes to him and says, "I shouldn't have done that. And because you did that, the sword will not depart from your house." And let's see, what was the other thing? "And I will raise up evil from your own house against you." He also says someone will sleep with your wives in broad daylight. But those are the things that he says with respect to David and his what will happen in his life hereafter. But Nathan also says, "But you're forgiven." He says, "The Lord has taken away your sin," and he said, "and you shall not die." Then after that, for the rest of 2 Samuel, David has tough times. Things get really rough. And most commentators look at this second half and they see that as God's punishment of David for what he had done wrong. And they see most everything that David does in the second half as being mistakes, things that he should not have done. I'm inclined to not be quite in agreement with that perspective. A lot of that is based on an assumption that I'm making. That doesn't sound like the God that I know, the God that we see in the rest of the Bible. That God is not vindictive. God does punish, and that's good and proper, but it is more discipline than it is punishment. I've mentioned that before, and I really think that that's important here. That God is bringing experiences into David's life which are going to raise issues for David that he's never really faced before, and in a way that he's never faced it before. And life is going to be tough. He's going to run for his life. He's going to grieve a lot as a result of what happens. But it is discipline in the sense that God is doing productive things in the life of David as well as in the lives of the people around him as this happens. And so I think that it's important to recognize that David doesn't become more wicked and more foolish in the second half, I don't think. It's just that he's faced with things that are particularly difficult, and given the fact that he has just been forgiven very much by God, and he recognizes that fact, that David wants to extend mercy to other people as they wrong him. Rather than acting vindictively, he wants to act mercifully towards them. And I think there's something good and proper about that. But what David is doing is he's trying to find the right balance between carrying out punishment that is a just punishment and extending mercy. And when do you do which and in what measure? And that's what he's wrestling with. So I don't think it's foolishness that accounts for the decisions that he makes. I think it's this struggle that he's going through. There is a sense in which, after the event with Bathsheba, God withholds from David that mercy, that grace with which David had that David had in the first half of 2 Samuel, where everything he does turns out great. In the first half, David being David works out very well. In the second half, David being David results in misery and difficulties. David was not responsible for the rebellion that occurred. On Judgment Day, I don't think God's going to come to David and say, you are responsible for Absalom's rebellion. Certainly, David plays a part in that, but I don't think his primary responsibility falls on him. That falls on Absalom, and it falls on the people of Israel, I think, primarily, not primarily on David. So David is learning something new and struggling with how to extend mercy and how to extend it wisely. And he is so appreciative of the mercy that he received that he's willing to extend mercy now in situations even where it's risky to him personally and even where it's risky to the kingdom as a whole. And that's what Joab keeps reminding him of. Because Joab's taking this other perspective. You've got to remember your king. You've got to remember that there are a lot of other people for whom you have responsibility, and as a result, a lot of other people that you have to take into account when you make your decisions. And you extending mercy to someone like Absalom is foolish, because Absalom is going to use that mercy against you. He's going to rise up again. I know he is. And it's not just you that will suffer again. It's the whole kingdom of Israel that's going to suffer. So Joab is this counterpoint saying you've got to keep in mind the whole kingdom. But what's curious about that is if David errs on the side of being merciful, Joab errs on the side of being vindictive. On three occasions in 2 Samuel, Joab puts to death commanders of opposing forces to David that David has tried to be reconciled with. Remember, it happens with Abner, who had been a commander under Saul. And David was going to make Abner the commander of his forces, and Joab chased him down and killed him because Abner had killed Joab's brother. Then later, he kills Absalom, even though David had said, do not kill Absalom. Joab does it. And then Amasa. So there are three times when Joab acted in disobedience to David's commands and killed someone with whom David was trying to reconcile. So Joab's tendency is to be vindictive. And as a result, we're going to see, it doesn't happen until 1 Kings chapter 2, Abner's going to be put to death. And it's at David's urging to Solomon before David died that he advised Solomon to put Joab to death. And that's what's going to happen. So we see there are kind of two pictures. We've got David and his understanding of mercy and his desire to extend mercy even to the extent of being risky. And on the other hand, we have Joab, who's vindictive, who wants to punish those who have been rebellious or have been in opposition. And I think in the whole of the narrative, what we're to see is David has the right leaning. That there is a balancing act that has to be done between mercy and punishment. But David wants to be forgiving. David wants to be conciliatory. And David, I think, emerges as the one that is to be emulated. Joab, on the other hand, wants to punish those who have ever done us any harm. And Joab, in the end, has to be put to death. Okay. Questions or comments?
Could you comment on, I guess, sincerity in the narrative? I mean, you pointed out the clues with Mephibosheth so that we know that he's sincere.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't seem like Shimei. It doesn't seem whether it's settled whether Shimei is telling the truth
right.
or not.
Right.
Is the narrator just since David forgave him? Does the narrator see that as occasion for us, or do we care? Or could you just comment?
Do care, and. The author of 1 Kings is going to tell us what will happen there. But at the risk of spoiling 1 Kings, David is also going to advise Solomon to kill Shimei as well. And so Shimei and Joab both die in chapter 2 of 1 Kings. So apparently what has happened is David decided to give Shimei the benefit of the doubt. But essentially what happens in the first couple chapters of 1 Kings is Solomon keeps Shimei on a short leash. And as soon as Shimei steps over the line, he's put to death. And that seems to be in the spirit of what David had recommended that he do. So that's why David's being ultra conciliatory here to try to heal the rift after the rebellion. But I don't think David trusts Shimei at this point either, and later on recommends offing him.
Hey, David. So what's the deal with all the wives?
What's the deal with what?
All the wives. Like, is there something in the law that where does monogamy come into the picture? Because I remember a little while back, you kind of mentioned something about David reading the law and, you know, kind of knowing the law. And is there something in is there nothing in the law that prohibits that sort of thing? And then also, would you tie in, if that is the case, that there's nothing in the law that up until David's time that prohibits that sort of thing?
There is something.
Oh, okay.
Well, it says in the law, in Deuteronomy, and I think it's also I couldn't say for sure whether it shows up in Numbers or Exodus, but it definitely shows up in Deuteronomy. There's a section where it says, when you get into the land and get established, you will want a king. And that will be a tricky thing. That will have its liabilities that come with it. But in that section it says, the king shall not multiply horses and shall not multiply wives. And in that same section it says, and the king will copy out this entire law and read it every year. So David clearly would have been aware of what the law required. But he multiplies wives. I don't know that he multiplies horses. I don't think he collects horses. But in both instances, why would a king want a bunch of wives? Usually, a king would accumulate wives because when you make treaties with other countries, the way that is sealed is by marrying a daughter of the king of that other country. That's what makes it solid. So apparently David is doing what all kings in that area did, and that is working out peace treaties with some of the surrounding kings. So David seems to be doing that very same thing, and they were commanded not to do that. Now, why does David feel justified in doing that? I don't know. he doesn't multiply horses. We'll see that his son Solomon multiplies both wives and horses and chariots. So he will do several things that the law prohibited, but that's what they did. One more quick one, then I better let people go.
Does with Joab, do you think with him, I mean, it's kind of interesting that all the other people he kills kind of sort of are rivals of his. Do you think there's some self-interest in that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Uh-huh. Yeah. I think jealousy is a significant part of it. It's part jealousy and part revenge, I think, are the two main motives that drive him.
When David has sort of Solomon clean houses, is he just getting cranky in his old age and kind of fed up with it all? Or do you think it's sort of his wisdom of he does recognize the value of the leadership role that Solomon and the transition that takes place between the son and the king in that instance is a very tenuous one.
Right.
So you think it's his sort of kingly wisdom in recognizing that, but isn't Joab an old guy at this point? Like, so I mean, what threat can these people be?
Yeah, I don't know for sure. I would guess that he's roughly the same age as David, but he might be a little younger. Mm-hmm. But they're cousins, so I suspect they're in the same relatively close in age. Why does David recommend to Solomon to kill these people? Clearly, the time when power for a king is most tenuous is when they first become established as a king, because that is always a time before a king becomes established and is able to get his people loyal to him in the right positions and stuff. It's vulnerable, and everybody knows that. And so when there's a power change, that's when you'll have anybody who is inclined towards rebellion, that's when you'll have them rising up. And we know from the text that there's a rival to the throne, Adonijah. And so I'm sure what's happened is David saying, you know, this is going to be really tricky. This is going to be really tenuous. And we know that there are some people in your midst that are problematic. And they are people that deserve to die a long time ago. You're going to need to get that done. Okay, thank you.